From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, Saving the American Brand and Making It in America, a tale of two companies, Kodak and GM. The auto industry is making a comeback, but as GM CEO Daniel Akerson tells us, being number one isn't enough.
It's a good indicator of potential future success, but we have a long, long road to walk.
Plus, Jackson Pollock at 100 and why speaking a foreign language has become a presidential liability.
Las palabras que elegí para expresarme no fueron las mejores.
Also, plagiarized books on Amazon with titles like
Lesbian MILF Seductress : Bride, Volume 1.
And LeVar Burton reads us The Snowy Day.
Crunch, crunch, crunch. His feet sank into the snow.
Plus, the French electronic duo Air meet filmmaker Georges Méliès.
We were scared of the reaction of the audience. We were thinking, oh my God, how can they dare to touch such a monument of cinema?
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Last week, a public radio producer named Rachel Ward and her colleagues at WXXI in Rochester started to record testimonials from people all around the city.
My name is Michael Spatolnik. I've lived in Rochester since 1959. Before that, I was raised in Hornell, New York.
And what brought you up to Rochester?
Kodak.
Right at the center of Rochester's skyline, a majestic building still dominates. The word Kodak still shines brightly from the top. It's George Eastman's legacy right there in brick and mortar. And yet today, Kodak is barely a shadow of its former self. Last week, it filed for bankruptcy protection. A company that in 1982 employed more than 60,000 people in Rochester has fewer than 7,000 workers today. The company basically invented digital photography, but it couldn't figure out how to make the transition from film quickly enough to outcompete its Asian rivals. And today, of the 10 best-selling digital cameras in the U.S., not a single Kodak. Now, just 3 years ago, two other iconic American brands, GM and Chrysler, were also on the ropes. Not anymore. And that's our cover story today, making things in America and saving the American brand. But first, more memories from Rochester.
It's Kodak Town. When we were young and not so well off, Kodak was our place for recreation. I went there for bowling, for dining. They helped subsidize my education.
Yeah, I met my wife there. And I worked way in the back, and I had to walk through the production areas to get to the cafeteria. And every day I'd walk by and...
He was this cute guy. He'd walk by with a coffee, and one day he came by and said hi and asked me to go get a cup of tea, and that's how we started talking.
Been together 32?
Mm-hmm.
32 years.
Girl from Kodak Town.
We're here to talk about memories, and Kodak was, you know, it was just the thing. My dad loved softball.
Did he play softball with Kodak?
Oh, yeah.
What position did he play?
He was an outfielder. He used to try to teach me a special way of catching a ball, and I still can't do it today. The old Willie Mays basket catch in front. He thought that was the best way to catch a ball. But Kodak, it meant so much to everybody here. I mean, we did everything around Kodak. I look at her and I say, well, General Motors, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, was in bankruptcy. Chapter 11, and they're out, and they're now they just understand that they're one of the strongest companies in the world now, back to being number one in autos. We can turn this around. We just got to come up with some better ways of doing things.
There's still good people at Kodak. It's always just been associated with quality and quality products, and who knows, maybe it'll never be the company that it was, but it still may become a viable company.
That's Rochester resident Michael Spatolnik. We also heard from Larry Arnone and from Bill James and his wife Katie. And that point that Larry made about GM, that was the centerpiece of President Obama's State of the Union speech on Tuesday.
We bet on American workers. We bet on American ingenuity. And tonight, the American auto industry is back.
Now, just 2 years ago, many people in this country and around the world assumed that the age of the American car manufacturer was over. And yet, when you come here to the Washington Auto Show, which opened this weekend, what's clear is how confident American automakers have become. There are hundreds of new models all across this showroom floor, and they're innovative cars in terms of their design and their prices. And probably one of the best slogans is Chrysler's. There's a huge sign above its newest sedan, and it reads, "Imported from Detroit." This month, GM and Chrysler are expected to post their best results since the start of the crisis. On Friday, Ford posted its biggest profit since 2009. And no one at the auto show sounded more confident about American manufacturing than Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood.
When I was here 3 years ago, and when I was in Detroit 3 years ago, it was like being at a funeral. Detroit this year was like being at a wedding, one of the best celebrations I've ever been at. The automobile industry is back, and it's back because President Obama decided he was going to make an investment. He was going to invest taxpayer dollars and very skilled workers, and GM and Chrysler are back. Chrysler's paid all the money back, and GM's paid almost all of it back.
Do you think those companies, particularly GM, had to kind of hit rock bottom, you know, in order to get to the point?
Look, I'm a forward-looking person. What I'm saying is GM is back. It's a great American story. It really is.
But how? How did American auto companies bounce back? And what can other American companies learn from that story?
Well, it's an extraordinary story. Summer of 2008, it was shocking to realize how much trouble GM really was in.
That's Bill Vlasic. He's the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. Think back to 2008, he says. GM, once the largest private sector employer in the country, was on the path to insolvency by the end of the year. No bank would lend GM money, so the Obama administration insisted the company declare bankruptcy, and with a giant federal bailout, they began a massive overhaul.
It was interesting that the leadership of General Motors had resisted Chapter 11, saying that people wouldn't buy a car from a bankrupt car company. Well, that was proven wrong. But more importantly, for the longest time, it was considered, well, we can't lose Pontiac, this storied brand with all this history that people care about. Well, guess what? When they closed a division, nobody cared.
Same with Saturn, right?
Same with Saturn. They resisted giving this up, but once they did, the company became more streamlined, more focused. Like they say, nothing focuses the mind like the noose. There's a humility there now that perhaps wasn't there before. That being said, did the American taxpayer get a good deal? Was it worth it? The estimates of the number of jobs that would have been lost in this country if GM had been allowed uncontrolled bankruptcy are in the hundreds of thousands. You know, are these saving these jobs in the communities and the manufacturing base worth $10 or $15 or $20 billion it'll ultimately end up costing? I think that's for your listeners to judge.
Humility, restructuring, tough decisions, and billions of government dollars to fall back on. It was enough to save American automakers, but what about smaller companies like Kodak and Rochester? Bill Vlasic says only one thing is certain. Kodak will come out of its bankruptcy a different kind of company.
They can't expect sentiment to save them. It has to be based on their ability to compete with not just companies around the world, but companies here in the United States, and whether or not they can tap into their sort of historical ingenuity and success and come up with the kind of products that can get them back on track.
Then there's the question of why it matters whether these iconic American brands survive or whether there's a good economic reason to make things in this country. Why does it matter whether our cameras or cars are made here? I put that question to Jennifer Granholm, the former governor of Michigan.
I mean, if we want as a nation, if we decide that we don't want to make things, you'd have to deal with the huge fallout, the massive job loss that would have ensued. But you would also have to deal with the consequence of a country that doesn't make anything. If we rely on other countries to build the stuff that we use, then we are completely at the mercy of others. If you want to have a strong country, you have to make things.
Jennifer Granholm, you may have seen some stories in the New York Times recently about why the iPod and the iPad were not being built in the United States. They're designed here. They're not built here. And one of the arguments raised was not because American workers are necessarily less efficient than Chinese workers, but simply because if you've got a factory in Shenzhen, China, and you need a part, you just go down to the factory next door and they can manufacture the part for you within hours.
Exactly right, because China has decided to get aggressive on attracting job providers. What we have done in the United States is we've decided that economic strategizing or planning or offering assistance to businesses to locate here is not what we do. This blind fealty to laissez-faire, hands-off economics might be nice in theory, but it no longer applies in a global economy when our economic competitors are not playing by the same rules. We cannot bring a knife to a gunfight, and that's exactly what we've done.
Have we missed the train, though? I mean, is there a way to revive manufacturing in America, or is that story pretty much over?
Absolutely not. We will not get back the investments that have been made by companies overseas because it's too expensive to bring those investments back. But we do have an incredibly innovative country. Products are being made all the time, and decisions are being made even as we speak right now by CEOs of manufacturing firms about where to locate. I think advanced manufacturing we can be competitive in. The lower skilled manufacturing with repetitive motion, we probably won't get that. But advanced manufacturing, you better believe we can do it.
I guess you would argue the best evidence for that is the auto industry. I mean, they are making a product that Americans are buying.
Amen, brother. The auto industry has been saved because there was a smart, strategic, active partnership with the federal government. Those who are running against President Obama would have let the industry die. That would have made us a weak nation. It would have been terrible strategy. We would have lost the manufacturing backbone, and that philosophy will harm our nation.
That's Jennifer Granholm. She's the former governor of Michigan. We also heard from Bill Vlasic of the New York Times. His book about the 2008 auto bailouts is called Once Upon a Car. Thanks to the production staff at member station WXXI in Rochester, New York, for helping us tell the story of Kodak. By the way, we should point out Rochester, in a lot of ways, the city's doing great, despite Kodak's bankruptcy. The University of Rochester is now the largest employer in town, and its medical research center is growing very quickly. There's even a budding music scene, including the music we've been hearing. It's by Rochester-based band Giant Panda Gorilla Dub Squad. This track is called Sunshine. General Motors' turnaround, as we just heard, has been described as something akin to a miracle and an achievement touted by President Obama Tuesday night in his State of the Union address.
Today, General Motors is back on top as the world's number one automaker.
Now, in some circles, GM is still derided as government motors. American taxpayers own about a quarter of GM's stock. But after a near-death experience in 2008, few would have predicted GM, just 3 years on, would once again become the world's biggest automaker. Daniel Akerson became CEO and chairman of GM in 2010. He's already shaken up the car company, and when I spoke with him, I asked why he's been reluctant to trumpet the good news that GM is now back on top.
Well, I mean, for a couple of reasons. A, I think humility is a nice trait for a corporation to have. And as I said publicly, that wasn't a goal we set out. It is a metric. It's a milestone toward a broader agenda, which includes we want to produce the world's best vehicles, improve our margins, our cash flow, and our profitability. So it's a good indicator of potential future success, but we have a long, long road to walk.
Now, I know and I've read that you really don't like what I'm about to say, this moniker, government motors, that some people call GM. And I understand why you wouldn't like that. So here's my question. What do you think it will take to free GM of government ownership?
Well, I don't like that because it implies that somehow the government is calling us on Monday and telling us that we're going to paint models coming off the production line a certain color, or that we're going to develop or prioritize vehicle development differently than we would if we were a profit-oriented organization. The objective of the government was not to act as, if you will, a private equity firm and try to maximize returns. Their objective, as I understood it at the time, and I think this is true to this day, was a broader agenda. It was for the industrial policy of the country. and for the well-being of its citizens. And that, I think, has been an unqualified success. And at some point in time, they will determine when they feel their mission has been accomplished and they will sell their shares.
Before you took this job, you were in private equity. And I've read that you are or you were a Republican, and I don't know either way if that's the case. But I'm curious about your view philosophically about this idea of the government intervening to bail out an industry. I mean, at the time, did you find it troubling, as many proponents of free enterprise have argued it was?
I think sometimes people stylize the image of how the economy works, because we have never been a truly 100% unadulterated capitalist system. Otherwise, your mother, as she aged in time, or your father, and could not produce, you don't kick them to the curb. You take care of your senior citizens, you take care of those among us that are unable to do as well as others, and you take care of your youth. And so there's this kind of hybrid, if you will, of our capitalist system. So there are times when government has a role, in my opinion, and there are times it should let the market ultimately determine winners and losers. In this particular instance, to have uncertainty surrounding a company of this size and this magnitude for a long period of time, I think would have been just devastating and probably have condemned it to the heap.
I want to ask you about the Volt, GM's plug-in electric hybrid. Firstly, it still accounts for a small fraction of sales. GM, of course, still makes most of its money in luxury brands and trucks and SUVs. So to what extent is electric really the future of the company?
This is a critical decade or two for the automotive, for the transportation industry, because of social needs. Do we want to leave an environment, a planet, that's better than the one we inherited from the prior generations? I have children and grandchildren, and indeed I want that. And so advanced propulsion is critical to the evolution of our means of transportation, and it will come. We are spending money, research and development dollars. We never abated on that. We spend on the order of $7.5 billion a year on advanced engineering, and it's all in an effort to prepare for the future, where you are propelling different forms of transportation and there's no carbon footprint.
The federal investigation looking into whether the Volt's battery could catch fire, of course, has been closed. GM has been cleared. But I wonder whether it still did some damage to the brand, and if so, how do you recover?
I think it did have some collateral damage, because it was a situation that ran on for 45 to 60 days and a lot of negative press. And it's kind of like you can do everything great, but the negative always gets amplified.
Dan Ackerson, how fragile is the comeback for GM?
Well, I think it's pretty solid, to be candid with you. I think we're doing well. This company sold over 9 million vehicles worldwide, and 2.5 million of those were sold in the United States. GM has the largest market share of any one company in the world as well. We are a great exporter of technology. We have good, diversified operations around the world, and indeed, I think we are producing, we're designing, building, and selling some of the world's best vehicles.
That's Daniel Ackerson. He's the chairman and CEO of General Motors, now once again the world's number one selling automaker. Daniel Ackerson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.
The artist best known for dripping and splattering paint across canvases, Jackson Pollock, was born 100 years ago on this date. And to mark the occasion, we headed down to the National Gallery of Art here in Washington to check out one of his most iconic paintings with the modern art curator there, Harry Cooper.
We are looking at a painting called Number One, and informally subtitled Lavender Mist.
Despite the fact there's no lavender or mist in it, there are violent stabs and drips of pastel colors, pinks and whites and aquamarines, with black slashes circling it like a web. And Pollock's not just working with splattered paint here.
There's a lot of stuff on it, bits of cigarette and other things. We see some handprints that Pollock very purposely placed in the upper corners and the upper edge.
Jackson Pollock's fame is based on this technique alone, but his career was much more varied than that. When he studied under Thomas Hart Benton, the American regionalist, Pollock's paintings were indistinguishable from Benton's, clear human forms with enhanced curves, as if windblown or carved like riverbeds. Now, over time, Pollock's forms would become more surreal, like Picasso's, but the trademark splatterwork didn't really make an appearance until Pollock was in his mid-30s.
He doesn't come to it really until 1947, and he dies in 56. So it's less than a decade, and in fact, by the end of 50 and 51, he's not doing the drips anymore.
But the splatterwork remains the focus of everyone's attention, even though it's always been divisive. From the very beginning, there were two camps, those who loved it and those who hated it.
He had some dealers behind him, important people like Peggy Guggenheim. But in the popular mind, he was Jack the Dripper. my child could do this. I think all of those feelings and associations have remained with the work, no matter how many books and how many retrospectives he has.
Yet in 2006, one of Pollock's paintings sold for $140 million. That made it the most expensive painting ever sold. So why does this man, whose work is as derided as it is desired, why does he have this lasting popularity?
De Kooning said Jackson broke the ice. He put the canvas on the floor. He stopped using brushes in the normal way. Yes, there's a randomness to it, but there's also a great order to it as well. He is a colorist, arguably in a great tradition of romantic painting, evoking atmosphere.
Would you say he is one of, or among the five or six most important American artists?
One of the three or four, yeah, I would say.
That's Harry Cooper. He is the curator of modern and contemporary art at the National Gallery of Art here in Washington, D.C. They've got two Jackson Pollock pieces on display there. You can see them both at our website, npr.org. Speaking a second language has recently become something of a liability for those aspiring to live in the White House. It turns out very few American presidents have had a strong command of a second language. Most of them in the early days of the Republic, and that language, it was French. John McWhorter wrote about this recently in the New Republic, and he's with me now. John, bonjour.
Bonjour, Kai. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. There was a time in the not-too-distant past when it was actually a virtue for a president or somebody who aspired to be the president to speak a foreign language, right?
Or at least to pretend. And so, for example, as little known as it is now, Herbert Hoover and his wife Lou actually spoke Chinese well enough to speak it with each other when they didn't want people to know what they were saying, and no one held it against Herbert that he spoke Chinese.
He was the original Manchurian candidate.
I
had no idea he spoke Chinese.
It's hard to imagine, isn't it?
Indeed. In a recent ad put out by Newt Gingrich, an anti-Romney ad, the ad is called The French Connection. Let's hear it.
Mitt Romney, he'll say anything to win. Anything. And just like John Kerry.
Laissez les bon temps rouler.
He speaks French, too.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Mitt Romney.
But he's still a Massachusetts moderate.
Mon Dieu.
The point is that there's this notion that if he actually has some command of another language, that it's somehow possibly disloyal or it's dishonest or it's phony. And I think some of this depends on what language you're caught speaking.
Now, Newt Gingrich apparently speaks some Spanish as well. A couple years ago, he had to apologize for some comments he made about Spanish, calling it the language of the ghetto. Here he is speaking in Spanish.
Las palabras que elegí para expresarme no fueron las mejores. Y lo que quise decir es esto.
He's actually not doing
not bad.
That badly.
No.
And I hear that he actually has been working on learning some Spanish, but then on the other hand, he has this notion that people who speak it in front of him who are not him are somehow condemned to a ghetto life or doing something that's kind of low rent, which is a bizarre way of looking at these things.
Now, John Huntsman, who I don't know if it was this reason that sunk his candidacy, but some cast some suspicion on the fact that he actually speaks very good Mandarin. Here's John Huntsman.
我说什么你都不会太知道,你都不会听得懂。我叫洪博培先生,我要当下来的美国总统。
Now, that's pretty impressive. I mean, I got to say, listening to that. And yet, in some ways, it was a liability for him, right?
Well, the funny thing about Chinese is that you have to be careful because since it's so unfamiliar to us and so exotic, if you're too showboaty about the fact that you know it, it might put some people off as putting on the dog somewhat. And I think that did not help Huntsman, although, of course, there were many larger issues than that.
Okay, you write about the one president in the history of the republic who actually was raised bilingual. That is Martin Van Buren. Tell me about Mr. Van Buren.
Martin Van Buren was raised in Dutch in New York when that was not uncommon, and English was his second language. Like many people, when they get upset, they revert briefly to their original language. When Martin Van Buren was in a tizzy, he would start cursing a little bit in Dutch. So he was our one truly bilingual president, and no one held it against him.
So when was the last time we had a president who spoke a passable second language?
I think that the answer to that question, if you don't count that right now we have a president who could hold a basic conversation in Indonesian, as quiet as he keeps this, I think that the last one really was Herbert Hoover, who could speak Chinese with his wife. That was the last president we've had who could go to another country and make his way around in the language and raise eyebrows with his rather fluent abilities.
There you go. I guess it's truly a virtue only to speak English if you want to make it to the White House.
That's the historical lesson that we can learn from all this. That's right.
John McWhorter is a contributing editor for The New Republic. He spoke to me from New York. John, merci.
Merci beaucoup, Guy.
Amazon's Kindle Direct Publishing platform is already revolutionizing the world of self-publishing. A few weeks ago on this program, we spoke with the paranormal romance fiction writer Amanda Hocking. She's made more than $2 million selling her ebooks through sites like Amazon's. And every day, thousands of budding authors are uploading their work to the site, creating a bookstore to rival the biggest libraries in the world. But with that, there are problems, and one potentially huge one.
Okay, my name is Shahrazad, and I go by Shar usually. That's a pen name.
Tell me what your books are about.
Well, they're about sex.
Shar is a rising star in Amazon's erotica section.
I do a lot of traveling, and most of my stories are travel-based in some way, either set in an exotic location or having to do with modes of transportation, trains, airplanes, buses.
But Shar is also an entrepreneur. She publishes erotica for other writers as well, including a story she put up on Amazon recently called Taking Jennifer.
So I was there watching Jennifer climb up in the rankings, and on the U.S. site, it eventually got to number 21 in the free erotica, and on the UK side it got to number 3. When you're that close to the top, then I think it's natural that you look around to see what the competition is like. So I took a look at the book that was holding fast at number 1, which is a book by an author called Maria Cruz, and the book was called My Sister Best Friend.
My Sister Best Friend.
I was being beaten by a book with an ungrammatical title. I mean, it's one thing to be beaten by my sister's best friend, but, you know, my sister, best friend. So I clicked on the author to see what else she'd written. And there were, I think, 42 titles, of which 41 were erotica. Also, many of them with ungrammatical titles. My Stepsister, Pretty Little Mouth, Dominating Her, but spelled D-O-M-E-N-A-T-I-N-G, Lesbian, MILF, Seductress, colon, Bride, Volume 1.
Maria Cruz was clearly prolific and successful, but one title seemed out of place. It was called Dracula Amazing Adventure.
And, you know, I've worked as a college professor, and my spidey senses were tingling, so I took a sentence from the description, and I put it between quotes and dropped it into Google, and Bram Stoker's Dracula came up. It was word for word Dracula.
Word for word.
Word for word, down to the correct punctuation.
And once she realized Dracula was plagiarized, Schar became curious about Maria Cruz's other books.
So I opened up their previews as well and began dropping sentences into Google. And every single one of them turned up somewhere else, mostly from the website literotica.com.
Maria Cruz was a fraud. Schar also came across another fraudulent and prolific author in the erotica category. He sold his books under the name Luke Ethan. He was selling a book called My Stepmom Loves Me, and it too was lifted from literotica.com. The original story was written by a man named Dave Springer, who lives in San Francisco. So it was the same exact story.
Even the misspellings.
Except Luke Ethan changed the title. Originally, it's called I Remember Mother.
I thought it was funny. I was complimented. To think that somebody thought my writing was good enough to try to sell to other folks. And I thought it was funny that the poor souls who were paying $3 for 28 pages online could have gotten it from several different places for free.
Amazon sold 187 copies of the book for a total of $559.13. And who is Luke Ethan? Well, not surprisingly, a made-up name. Turns out the man behind the name lives in Kuwait. He claims he purchased the rights to the book through a third party. And the person who tracked Luke down and who wrote about Schar, Dave Springer, and other writers who were plagiarized on Amazon is Adam Pennenberg. His article appeared in the January issue of Fast Company magazine. How big is this problem?
If you get in there and start checking out some authors will have 30, 40, 50 different e-books that they'll post over a very short period of time. And, you know, in the erotica world, and the numbers just keep growing every day. And then eventually maybe Amazon shuts them down because they find out that their plagiarized works. And then they just start up again, sometimes under the same name and other times under different pen names.
Okay, now why does erotica seem to be sort of ground zero of all this plagiarism?
You know, I think other genres are afflicted by this. There are a lot of plagiarized books in how-to. You know, what they do is they find a how-to guide on the internet, they copy and paste it, and all of a sudden, all these different books with that same exact information are being sold under different names. Business books or like how to invest in insurance funds or something like that, you know, books that are targeted for a specific market, they're ripe for plagiarism as well.
What responsibility does Amazon have, you know, legally speaking, for this? Any?
Well, that is a very good question. Some might say you could point to Amazon Kindle's agreement, and in it, it does say, in one of the clauses, if you believe that your work was illegally infringed, then Amazon Kindle will pay you the royalties for that. Now, there's also laws that govern this. There's the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and that has some complexity as well.
Well, if Amazon says they're going to pay you the royalties, then they should be paying David Springer the royalties that Luke Ethan received, right?
You would think so, but then it gets down to, well, who gets to decide? It's copyright infringement. And the only one who can do that is a judge. And that's a pretty high standard. And so Amazon could hide behind that.
And David Springer's clearly not going to go to court for a few $100.
No, he's not.
This seems to me like it's going to be a bigger and bigger problem. Right. I mean, as e-publishing becomes more and more dominant and more people start to self-publish online.
I think it's equivalent to spam. You know, the vast majority of spam is intercepted by ISPs and gateways. But a lot does get through. That shows you just how much is sent. And, you know, the same thing is happening with e-books where it's much easier to make money. All you got to do is steal some content or make up some content, induce someone to buy it. If there's shame attached to erotica, that makes it even easier because people are less likely to complain about it. And so you end up with a situation where you can make some money and it comes in whether you do anything or not. So you just post it once. Amazon doesn't see it for a while and you get 4 or 5, 6 months worth of royalties and you know, make a few $100. And if you do that enough, you do have enough books on there, you can make some good money.
That's Adam Pennenberg. He teaches journalism at NYU. His article, Amazon's Plagiarism Problem, appeared in the January issue of Fast Company magazine. We also reached out to Amazon to be part of the story. The company provided a written statement that says it's worked steadily to detect and remove books that violate copyright. Amazon's agreement with authors indemnifies the company for damages against copyright violations, and once you agree to the terms, Amazon isn't responsible. By the way, those books by Maria Cruz and Luke Ethan, they're no longer available on Amazon.com. One morning, many years ago, a little boy in Brooklyn named Peter woke up to an amazing sight. Fresh snow.
After breakfast, he put on his snowsuit and ran outside. The snow was piled up very high along the street to make a path for walking.
That's Reading Rainbow's LeVar Burton reading from the groundbreaking book The Snowy Day by Ezra Jack Keats.
Crunch, crunch, crunch. His feet sank into the snow. He walked with his toes pointing out, like this. He walked with his toes pointing in, like that. Then he dragged his feet slowly to make tracks. And he found something sticking out of the snow that made a new track. It was a stick. A stick that was just right for smacking a snow-covered tree.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of The Snowy Day, which, when it came out in 1962, was the first major kids' book to feature a black protagonist who wasn't a caricature. Ezra Jack Keats won the Caldecott Medal for his work, the highest award for a children's picture book.
Well, the first page is the hook. It grabs the reader. There's a beautiful two-page spread of Peter in his pajamas looking out his window from his bed into the snow. The city is covered with snow.
That's Deborah Pope. She's the executive director of the Ezra Jack Keats Foundation. And as she explains, the book brings to life a magical moment some children get to experience.
When you realize, one, you don't have to go to school, and two, you get to play in this world that is all yours. It's all yours. The snow is there just for you. And you can see that. You can see that expression in Peter's face.
The one thing that is never mentioned in the text, Deborah, it just doesn't seem like it's a big deal at all, but in fact it was at the time, is that Peter, this boy Peter, is African-American.
Yep. Yep.
Why wasn't it ever mentioned?
Because it wasn't important. It wasn't the point. The point was that this is a beautiful book about a child's encounter with snow and the wonder of it, and the difficulties, the being rejected by older kids, the realization that snow doesn't last, it's not forever. This is not about color. This is about childhood.
He thought it would be fun to join the big boys in their snowball fight, but he knew he wasn't old enough, not yet. So he made a smiling snowman, and he made angels. He pretended he was a mountain climber. He climbed up a great big tall heaping mountain of snow and slid all the way down.
This is a visually beautiful book. It's very simple. The art is very simple. It's collage-like. Peter is obviously central in this book. There are all these images that are now iconic. You know, Peter in this red costume, his brown skin against the white snow. Was Ezra Jack Keats trying to make a statement? Was he consciously trying to make a statement when he wrote this book and made Peter an African-American?
This book, it's hard to answer that question because part of the answer would be yes and part of the answer would be no. Yes, because he said, well, all the books he had ever illustrated, there had never been a child of color. And they're out there. They should be in the books, too. And so he wanted to put a child of color into his book. But was he trying to make a cause book? Was he trying to make a point? No, he wasn't. He was writing a book about a child. Some of the criticism that he received had to do with the fact that he didn't mention that this was a child of color.
I mean, at the time, this was 1962. This was quite controversial. Some African-Americans, like Langston Hughes, praised Ezra Jack Keats, sent him a letter praising the book.
Yes.
But others, civil rights activists and others, felt that this book didn't go far enough.
They were worried. This was, as you pointed out, it was a tumultuous time. It was a time in which the African-American community was fighting for its place at the table, was fighting to be heard. And here we have this book, And in the past, when white authors had written about black characters, it had not done well. It was not good. It wasn't good. And so their reaction was, I believe, defensive. And then they realized, because of the way it was embraced, because the reaction that teachers and parents and children, because of their positive experience and reaction to the book, was overwhelming, the criticism subsided. It was no longer necessary that the book say, I am an African-American child going out into the snow today. They realized you don't put a color on a child's experience of the snow.
He picked up a handful of snow, and another, and still another. He packed it round and firm and put the snowball in his pocket for tomorrow. Then he went into his warm house. He told his mother all about his adventures while she took off his wet socks. And he thought and thought and thought about them.
This character, Peter, is inspired by a real person, right?
It's inspired by an image that he cut out of Life magazine in the early 1940s, a strip of four photographs of a little boy, an African-American boy, who has been chosen to receive an experimental vaccine in Georgia. And this kid is like a little dollop of sunshine. In the first frame, he's just beaming out at the camera. He's so happy. He's been chosen. He's going to be given something special. He's a little boy. In the second frame, he's beginning to offer his arm. He wants to know, well, is this going to hurt? And the third, he's really got his arm out, and he gets the vaccine. And in the last frame, he's so hurt. He's pulled his arm back in to him, to his chest, and he's looking out at the camera with such quizzical pain. How could you have hurt me? And Ezra, didn't know why this series of pictures moved him, but he cut it out. He kept it with him for 20 years. And when he was given the chance to make a book of his own, that's when he realized why he had chosen to keep this picture with him for so many years. It was this child who entered the world with such joy and had to deal with the pain that very often comes.
Of course, this book went on to win the coveted Caldecott medal. How did children react to this book?
Well, children embraced this book. Kids who grew up in Iowa or in Florida, kids who never see snow. And so Ezra got tons of mail from kids with pictures of Peter, of the snowman, of the snow angels. And perhaps most movingly, there was a teacher wrote into Ezra saying, the kids in my class, for the first time, are using brown crayons to draw themselves. These are African-American children. Before this, they drew themselves with pink crayons, but now they can see themselves.
That's Deborah Pope. She's the executive director of the Ezra Jack Keats Foundation and a childhood friend of the late author himself. You can see some of the illustrations from The Snowy Day and hear the rest of LeVar Burton's reading at our website, npr.org.
While he slept, he dreamed that the sun had melted all the snow away. But when he woke up, his dream was gone. The snow was still everywhere. New snow was falling. After breakfast, he called to his friend from across the hall, and together they went out into the deep, deep snow.
Time now for music and a film score 110 years in the making. In 1902, the very genesis of filmmaking, director Georges Méliès released his magnum opus, Le Voyage dans la Lune, A Trip to the Moon, the first science fiction film ever. You know the famous shot of the moon with a human face, and then it grimaces when a spaceship lands right in his eye? That's the movie I'm talking about. Méliès hand-painted each frame of his movie for special screenings. It was once in color. But those hand-painted reels were lost for decades. That is, until they were rediscovered in Barcelona back in 1993. Archivists worked for years to restore the badly damaged film, and for its soundtrack, they asked the French duo known as Air to write the score. The restored version debuted at the Cannes Film Festival back in May, and the soundtrack album is coming out in a few days. Nicolas Godin and Jean-Benoît Dunkel are Air. They'd heard rumors that the long-missing color reels had been found, and Nicolas Godin could hardly believe it.
It was like a legend. It was like the Loch Ness Monster.
They didn't know what colors these kids were.
No, because when it was done in 1902, they were selling the film to some theaters, and the theaters would show the movie until destruction. So really, none of them has been survived. So it was like, oh my God, I can't believe we're going to see it. You know, it was like a big big moment, because many people heard about that movie, but no one ever would have seen it.
They saw, of course, a black and white version of it,
yeah,
but never
it's
a color
different.
Version. Right.
The black and white version is more like a piece of museum, you know? The colored version is more like you watch it like you would watch a normal movie, you know? It's really cool.
It's also terrifying, and you can imagine watching that in 1902. Of course, the basic story is a spaceship lands on a moonscape, and all these men emerge from the spaceship wearing, obviously, period clothing, so top hats and long-tailed coats, and out pop mushrooms in this landscape, these sort of technicolor mushrooms, and then aliens begin to attack them, and they fight against the aliens, and the aliens sort of disappear in puffs of smoke. It's a very psychedelic film, actually.
Yeah,
I think I would get the fear if I watched that film back in my college days.
Yeah, that's the reason why we wanted to use some fear sounds, and that's why we didn't choose to use like a traditional soundtrack, you know, like it used to be in 1902 with the piano, like a ragtime piano.
And by the way, for folks listening to this conversation, obviously this is very visual. You can see what we're talking about if you go to our website, npr.org. There's a piece on this record. It's called Décollage. And it seems to hint at Stanley Kubrick's use of Strauss in 2001. And I don't know whether you thought of that, but did you sort of borrow from other science fiction scores in your compositions?
No, but talking about Strauss and Zarathustra, there's the big timpanis, you know? Mm. And this is the main instrument we experiment on this album. It's been a long time when we wanted to try to record with timpanis, and so we crossed the line this time. We rented some big timpanis, and we put them on a lot of songs. But I think all the other references to science fiction soundtracks is more like in our subconscious, because we do music in a very instinctive and spontaneous way. And then when we listen to the record, we say, oh, this reminds me of this movie, this reminds me of this movie, you know, it's in our blood.
My guests are Nicolas Godin and Jean-Benoît Dunkel. They're the electronica duo known as Air, and their new record is a score to the century-old silent film Le Voyage dans la Lune. You guys have obviously done film scores. You've done work for Sofia Coppola's films of The Virgin Suicides and Lost in Translation. How did you do the music for this? Did you watch it over and over and over again, you know, with instruments in front of you?
Yeah, we watched the movie all day long for like 1 month. It was like very intense. At some point, I remember I was so familiar with the movie that I felt part of the team back in 1902, and I can see how much fun they had to shoot that movie. I can feel the energy, the fact that they were so young by the time. I discovered that with Virgin Suicide, is that because when you look at a movie all day long, you start to know all the moves of the actors, and you know exactly what that is doing, and so you feel part of the set at some point. So I really felt after 1 week, I've been hired by Georges Méliès to compose the music of his movie, you know?
Wow.
I felt part of the whole process. It was very strange.
And Méliès did not write a soundtrack for this film in 1902, right?
No, he was not thinking of music when he was doing this movie because cinema was not associated with sound. And when they asked us to do that, we wanted to be sure that really he has no indication, no recommendation. He really have no thought about any music on the top of it because we never wanted to take the place of someone else or to betray the work of a composer.
Worked together, the two of you, a long time, and clearly you have a strong partnership and presumably a strong friendship. Is it easy to work together? Is it just kind of flow?
Oh, we are like a couple, you know. We have good moments and bad moments. The important thing is that we are different. We like to kill a lot of the other ideas. It's always like the melodies that you hear on the record are the surviving things. It's like evolution, you know. I mean, the species that survive are the most adapted to to the situation, and we are applying this kind of method to our music, so it's a lot of artistic fight.
I read that you guys worked on a very tight schedule to finish this music. Why?
Because I think they were so scared not to be able to achieve such an ambitious restoration process. And when they were close to finish, there was so much buzz around this movie that they decided to show it at the Cannes Film Festival, so they were not expected such a short deadline. So when they called us, they said, look, sorry, but in 1 month from now, it's going to be shown at the Cannes in the south of France, and that's it. There's nothing we can do about it. So we were pretty scared because we just finished the day or 2 days before. You know, we were scared of the reaction of the audience. We were thinking, oh my God, how can they dare to touch such a monument of cinema? So when we were in Cannes, I was very stage fright, and the light went dark, and I was the giant screen because we worked on a computer. I saw what we have done, and I said, oh my God, this was much more like spectacular than I imagined. And after 15 minutes, people start to applaud. And that was such a relief for me. I did not enjoy that night because I was so stage fright.
You were terrified because, of course, you take on this sacred film and you're worried that people are going to say, what is this music?
Yes, exactly.
And, of course, they didn't.
No, because we help the movie. We serve the movie. We make the movie entertaining. And that was the dream of Méliès, to have an audience. And now, with the color and the music, this movie is such a good piece of art, and people are fun, people are entertained, you know, it's great.
All of you will be back home safely. So, join us with no fear on our fantastic trip to the moon.
Nicolas Godin and Jean-Benoît Dunkel are the duo known as Air. Their new record is an imagined score to the 1902 silent film Le Voyage dans la Lune. You can hear a few tracks and see a snippet of the film at our website, nprmusic.org. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for the week ending January 29th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. Our program this week was directed by Petra Mayer and edited by Mathoni Maturi. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Tasneem Shama, and Kenya Young. Lauren Beneshu is our intern. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be right back.
cool.